So far in this project, we have talked about integrity as a kind of unity, or integrity in relation to the concept of unity. And it's been, I think it's fair to say, a philosophically oriented understanding of what integrity might mean, as well as a person-oriented understanding of what integrity might mean. And I think that they are entirely worthwhile ways of thinking about integrity that also connect quite emphatically with what Arendt has to say about the term, although she only quite rarely in her work uses it explicitly. I'm going to be identifying a couple of those instances that sort of trace out the conversation about integrity that I think it would be helpful to stage in relation to her thinking today. But the reason that I think Arendt is particularly useful for staging a conversation about integrity is that while she has a profound investment in trying to understand what it means when we think and how we can think responsibly, she's also, I think, quite useful in moving the conversation about thought and action away from the individual and examining how those how the concepts that she works with, plurality, and I suppose integrity in a roundabout sort of way, can be related to larger questions to do with space, to do with the political, and to do with what it means to live in a community with other people where we appear to one another, we appear in, we present ourselves to one another, and we act as individuals, but also in concert. And this question of what it means to act in concert, to act through appearance within a sphere populated by one's equals, one's political equals, is really crucial to what Arendt has to say about modernity, about mass society, and about what's been lost specifically qua the political. So, when it comes to the question of integrity, she very much builds on the kinds of conversation we've been having so far. She evidences an enormous respect for Socrates in her writing, and in fact, in many ways, her account of the political in quite a large number of the texts that she wrote, both in long form and in short form, take Socrates as a kind of starting point. Her argument being that in many ways, the death of Socrates signifies a fundamental disjunction between the world of the public, of politics, of the political, and the world of thinking and the realm of the mind. This division that she draws between the public and the private, and it's not as straightforward as that, but I'm just going to stick with that distinction for the time being, is sort of fundamental to everything that she has to say about the political. And I also think it's fundamental to any account of what she has to say about integrity. And the reason that I think that this is interesting is because it pushes our focus away from the integrity of the thinking individual. It pushes our focus away from the integrity of the mind. And it even pushes our focus away from the integrity of action. And instead encourages us to attend to the integrity of spaces, the integrity of spaces that are identified as necessary for enabling particular kinds of human activity. Now, this isn't to say that she doesn't have anything to say about integrity in relation to thinking, in relation to doing, but it is, I think, to raise an important qualification to the conversation that we've been staging so far. In that, it forces us to address the question of whether we should think of a person as being able to act with pure integrity, and in fact, whether the idea of integrity places too high an expectation on individuals. So when she talks about Socrates, and when she discusses Socrates as a figure who marks out the limits of the political, or rather the limit where the political and the philosophical sort of become mutually exclusive, What she's, I think, encouraging us to do is to attend to the delimitations, attend to the sort of conceptual boundaries that are drawn between different spheres of action, and encouraging us to think about the integrity of those lines, of those conceptual divisions. And the preservation of these realms and the preservation of these conceptual lines, I think, is sort of central to what she has to say about integrity as a concept. And that's sort of where I want to direct our attention today. Now, if I can just pause for a second, I want to do two things now. I first of all want to explain why I started this session online with a discussion of Arendt's response to the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem. And second, to explain my motivations for choosing these texts, because they're not the most obvious texts when discussing Arendt and integrity. So first, to take the question of Arendt's response to the Eichmann trial. As I mentioned in my introduction, this was a moment in Arendt's life when she is quite frequently taken to have demonstrated integrity, demonstrated it to almost a perilous degree. It certainly cost her, and her commitment to autonomous thinking, the right to speak one's mind, and the necessity of thinking about what we're doing. She famously says that what she is in the process of doing is, what she wants us to do is to think what we are doing. She insists on all of those things, and so I think has been interpreted as demonstrating a very particular species of integrity. Her integrity was also called into action, called into question, rather, during this time. So I think that from a biographical point of view, it's always necessary when discussing Arendt, certainly in the context of integrity, to bear that in mind. Having said that, there is a terrible tendency, I think, when discussing Arendt, to reduce everything that she has to say to the question of the Eichmann trial, certainly when it comes to popular engagements with her thought. And in fact, her thought massively exceeds what she has to say about the Eichmann trial, and I really want to resist that. Nonetheless, it's a necessary contextual piece of information that one has to bear in mind when discussing Arendt and the concept of integrity. So, in order to complicate that biographical detail, which recently has been the source of in my opinion, a very good film by Margarete von Trotter about Hannah Arendt and the Eichmann controversy, I wanted to choose texts that allowed us to move beyond the question of Eichmann and Arendt's relationship with that historical moment. I wanted to do this in two ways. First of all, I wanted to alight on, I think, another and in some ways more important example of a moment in which she insists on the autonomy of the thinking mind and how that is connected with one's own philosophical integrity. And that relates to her essay, Reflections on Little Rock, which was also very controversial. I was at a talk last week in which the speaker talked about the things that Arendt needs to be applauded for, and the things that perhaps she might have to apologise for. And Reflections on Little Rock was explicitly identified as something that there is perhaps an expectation that she should regret were she alive today. I have heard people express themselves in terms of Arendt is dead wrong. She is completely wide of the mark in this, and it's a fundamental misreading of the circumstances. But what's particularly interesting, I think, when it comes to Reflections on Little Rock, is that there is both a preface and an answer after the essay in the collection that we're working with, which serves to contextualise the essay without apologising for the fact that Arendt felt that something needed to be said in the first place. And in the preface, it's a very sort of interesting moment when Arendt acknowledges that several months have passed and that information has come to light that might complicate her point of view, but she rather bloody-mindedly says, I'm publishing this anyway, publish and be damned. She was then attacked for it, and she issues a response to her attackers at the end of the essay, which again says, well, I think I've been misread. I think I've been misread grievously in one case. And what I'm going to do now, instead of issuing a line-by-line rebuttal, I'm going to restate what I said in the first place, but I'm going to do so in a slightly more anecdotal and accessible way. Now, again, this context, the relationship between integrity on the one hand and bloody-mindedness on the other, it very much is raised as a question. On the train up, if I can speak just anecdotally for a second, Adam and I were talking about the idiom that Arendt uses and the fact that she's unapologetically rarefied in the language that she uses and has been interpreted as sort of talking above people rather than talking to them. She's not a particularly sensitive interlocutor, and she's on record as saying in an interview that she wasn't a particularly agreeable person. And I think you can definitely get that sense of the kind of thinker that she was from her essays that we're looking at today. Nonetheless, they do demonstrate, I think, of extraordinary integrity. And it's that question of the biographical details and whether she demonstrates integrity to a fault that I think we can address first of all. The second reason for it selecting this material in particular actually relates to truth and politics, which I keep coming back to. I've engaged with Arendt quite widely now, but I find myself coming back to this essay again and again and again. And that's because she is engaging in a conversation about what the role of truth outside the political realm is and should be. She acknowledges that, she sketches that out briefly, but then she thinks quite carefully about what the role of truth is inside the political realm. And integrity in both of those contexts means something quite different. Moreover, in again drawing quite an emphatic line, and I hope you'll agree with me that the line that's drawn in Truth and Politics seems, at least on the surface, to be really quite emphatic indeed. In drawing this line quite emphatically, she again draws our attention to the idea that integrity is not a faculty of the individual. It's not even a performative faculty of the individual, necessarily. It also relates to the spaces of presentation in which we move, in which we operate, and the spaces of privacy in which we move and operate, and how we draw distinctions between those two, and how vital it is that we attend to the distinction between these two worlds. In other words, it raises the question about the integrity of the political and the integrity of the private as spheres of human activity. So, as ways into this, I thought I'd identify a couple of moments in the material that we've been looking at where Arendt explicitly raises the concept of integrity. And that will at least provide us with opening sections to address. So the first, if you've got this book, is on page 244 in Reflections on Little Rock, when she provides a definition of integrity, which is quite different from the definition with which we've been working so far. She's writing about the famous picture of a young black girl basically being harried and harassed by a group of young white people, and reflecting on what it is about this image that concerns her quite so much. And she writes of the sense of being unwanted and how that relates to persecution. And she sees the distinction between these two things. On the one hand, the sense of being unwanted, and then on the other hand, the sense of being persecuted, as carving out a crucial distinction between the social, on the one hand, and the political, on the other. And to her, the distinction between the social and the political is really quite important. So just to read this passage. Psychologically, the situation of being unwanted, a typically social predicament, is more difficult to bear than outright persecution, a political predicament, because personal pride is involved. By pride, I do not mean anything like being proud of being a Negro, or a Jew, or a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, etc., but that untaught and natural feeling of identity with whatever we happen to be by the accident of birth. Pride, which does not compare and knows neither inferiority nor superiority complexes, is indispensable for personal integrity. And it is lost, not so much by persecution as by pushing, or rather being pushed into pushing, one's way out of a group and into another. If I were a Negro mother in the South, I would feel that the Supreme Court ruling, unwillingly but unavoidably, has put my child into a more humiliating position than it had been in before. The argument here hinges on a sense that the integrity of this child is being called into question. And that's troubling, first of all, because the idea of integrity and its connection with pride carries value in itself. But also because it draws into a state of crisis the relationship between the social on the one hand and the political on the other. So we see a concatenation of pride as something that one has, that one as an individual possesses or doesn't possess, and also a concatenation of that with this sense of there being two distinct realms. The second and third, to sketch out briefly and to finish off, arrive on at the end of Truth and Politics on page 573 and 574, respectively. Now, in this essay, Arendt is very concerned with, or by this point in this essay, I should say, Arendt is very concerned with thinking about thinking and what it means to think with integrity. So she talks about the historian Herodotus. She writes, Herodotus tells us in the very first sentences of his stories that he set out to prevent, quote, the great and wondrous deeds of the Greeks and the barbarians from losing their due meed of glory. This is the root of all so-called objectivity, rational truth, as she refers to it throughout the essay. This curious passion, unknown outside Western civilization, for intellectual integrity at any price. Without it, no science would ever have come into being. Now here, we're talking about integrity as something that one has, one exercises, one performs, one does, in thinking as an individual. And then just over the page, we see again this shift towards an understanding of integrity as relating to our need to attend to the spheres of human activity. And this is the very end of the essay. What I meant to show here is that this whole sphere, its greatness notwithstanding, is limited, that it does not encompass the whole of man's and the world's existence. It is limited by those things which men cannot change at will, and it is only by respecting its own borders that this realm, where we are free to act and to change, can remain intact, preserving its integrity and keeping its promises. Conceptually, we may call truth what we cannot change. Metaphorically, it is the ground on which we stand and the sky that stretches above us. So we see again here in these two passages, integrity being used in this double-edged way, continuing the conversation that we've been staging so far about integrity and its relationship with the individual, but also suggesting that there is a spatial dimension to integrity, even if that spatiality is conceptual only, and that this spatial understanding of integrity is also vital to acknowledge, understand, attend to, and reproduce.